This is the presidential series from TP Newsroom, a four-part look at how modern presidents shaped policy, power, and the country we're living in today. Each entry stands alone, but together they show the long arc of decisions that built the America we inherited. Part 1, Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan didn't create the American dream, but he sold it better than anyone else. He was the president who smiled while saying hard things, who made the complicated feel simple, who stepped onto the political stage at a time when America was tired, uncertain, and unsure of itself. And that's what made him so effective. That's also what made him dangerous. Reagan was a communicator before he was a policymaker. He came to power during a time when America didn't want nuance. It wanted confidence. After a decade of gas shortages, inflation, embassy takeovers, and presidential scandals, the public wasn't looking for policy papers. They were looking for reassurance, and Reagan gave it to them.
With a deep awareness of the responsibility conferred by your trust, I accept your nomination for the presidency of the United States.
His voice was calm, his presence was stable, his message was patriotic. To millions, he didn't just look like the answer, he sounded like one, and that mattered more than most people are willing to admit. But beneath the calm, beneath the style, were choices, hard ones, calculated ones. And whether you believe Reagan saved the country or set it on a dangerous path depends entirely on what you're willing to look at. He said, "Government is not the solution to our problem, government is the problem." That was his core philosophy. And with that phrase, 10 words long, he launched a movement. A movement that pushed for smaller government, lower taxes, less regulation, and more room for private enterprise. For many, it felt like freedom. For others, it meant abandonment. Entire industries were deregulated. Safety nets were reduced. Labor unions were weakened. And while the economy did grow for some, wage growth stalled for others. The stock market surged. So did homelessness. Reagan's appeal wasn't just policy, it was emotional. He had the rare ability to make Americans feel good about themselves again, even if their material circumstances weren't improving. And that was part of his genius, because even when data said one thing, his delivery said another, and people believed the delivery, not because they were gullible, but because they were exhausted. They didn't want to do the math. They wanted to believe in the myth.
The Constitution of the United States. So help you God. So help me God. Now, congratulations, sir.
That myth had consequences. In a taped phone call with Richard Nixon in 1971, before he was president, Reagan made a private comment about African delegates at the United Nations, calling them monkeys, who were still uncomfortable wearing shoes. It was ugly, racist, but it was also revealing, because throughout his presidency, Reagan would often use coded language to talk about crime, welfare, and race. He wasn't overt. He didn't need to be. He just told stories, like the one about the welfare queen in Chicago, an exaggerated, racially charged narrative that helped justify major cuts to public assistance programs. And people believed it, because the story felt true, even if it wasn't. Still, it would be dishonest to paint Reagan as some cartoon villain. He wasn't. He was complex. He ended the Cold War without a shot being fired. He stood in front of the Berlin Wall and demanded that it be torn down. He built alliances with unlikely leaders. He pulled America out of its post-Watergate slump and gave people a reason to believe in the presidency again. And for many voters, especially older Americans, white working class families, and business owners, he represented a kind of leadership that felt firm, fair, and aspirational. That matters too. But so does the other side. The cost of that optimism was often paid by people with less power. Black families swept up in the war on drugs, LGBTQ+ Americans left to die in silence during the AIDS crisis, laborers pushed out of union protection, children whose school lunches disappeared in budget cuts. The headlines from Reagan's era were filled with hope. The footnotes were filled with pain. So, what do you do with a president like that? Someone who made people feel proud and invisible at the same time? Someone who projected strength on the world stage but allowed suffering to fester at home? Someone who preached morality while running covert operations that broke international law? That's the story we're telling, not to convince anyone, but to finally tell it all at once. This series isn't here to make you love Reagan or hate him. That's not the point. The point is to understand what he did, how he did it, and why every president since has either tried to follow his lead or undo his legacy. Because Reagan didn't just reshape the country, he reshaped the presidency, and he set the tone for every debate we're still having. Taxes, government spending, personal responsibility, patriotism, crime, capitalism, religion, race, all of it traces back to the moment when a former actor took center stage, smiled, and said, "Trust me, this isn't about blaming him for everything, but we are going to track what he touched, the policies he signed, the powers he expanded, the people he ignored. We're going to show how Reagan didn't just lead a country, he taught it how to see itself differently, and whether that vision was hopeful, harmful, or both is something we'll uncover one signature at a time, because behind every myth is a paper trail, and behind every paper trail is a choice, and Ronald Reagan made a lot of them. Ronald Reagan didn't waste time once he got in office. From day one, the mission was clear. Government needed to be smaller, leaner, quieter. Not because it wasn't working, but because he believed it was working too much. The government had gotten too involved in people's lives. It had become too visible, too noisy, too expensive, and Reagan wanted to shrink it. Not tweak it, not reform it, shrink it. That was the plan. So the first thing he did was go after taxes. In 1981, just months into his presidency, Reagan pushed through the Economic Recovery Tax Act, the biggest tax cut in American history at the time. The top marginal tax rate dropped from 70% to 50%. Corporate taxes got cut. Capital gains taxes were slashed. The logic? If the wealthy had more money, they'd invest it. If businesses had more freedom, they'd create jobs. That money would trickle down to everyone else. That was the theory, and to a lot of people it sounded good, it sounded simple, it sounded fair. But what happened wasn't trickle down. What happened was trickle up. The wealthiest Americans saw massive gains. Corporate profits rose. The stock market got stronger. But middle class wages stayed flat, and working class families started falling behind. Not all at once, but steadily, quietly. The gap between the rich and the poor didn't just grow, it widened into a canyon. In 1980, the top 1% of Americans held about 8% of the nation's wealth. By the end of Reagan's presidency, that number was over 13%, and it's been climbing ever since. Meanwhile, federal deficits exploded. That part never gets talked about enough. Reagan came into office railing against big government spending, but under his leadership, the national debt tripled, not doubled, tripled. Because while taxes were being cut, military spending was going up fast, and the safety nets that were supposed to catch people as the economy shifted, those were getting cut too. This is where Reagan's second major move came in: budget cuts to domestic programs, education, housing, food assistance, public health. Almost every social program on the books saw reductions. But the cuts didn't just shrink spending, they reshaped public expectations. Federal funding for civil rights enforcement dropped. Head Start programs were scaled back. Mental health care was decentralized, pushing responsibility onto states without giving them the resources to manage it. Homelessness surged, not just because of drugs or job loss, but because entire support systems disappeared in the name of efficiency. Some were gutted, others were frozen. Funding for public housing dropped by nearly 80%. School lunch programs were restructured. The idea was to promote personal responsibility. Let states handle it. let communities step up, but many of those communities were already struggling. The cracks got wider. And for the people living on the edge, Black families in urban centers, rural white families in factory towns, single mothers on fixed incomes, the floor gave out. This wasn't just economic policy. It was philosophy turned into law. Reagan believed that the government created dependency, that if you gave people help, they'd stop trying. And that belief was baked into everything he signed. When critics warned that people would be left behind, his administration responded by pointing to fraud, laziness, and waste. He warned that people would be left behind, not with data or policy breakdowns, but with stories. And his favorite was, and remains, the Washington trope of a woman in Chicago who abused welfare. Here's exactly what Reagan told crowds on the campaign trail. There is a woman in Chicago who has been collecting welfare under 8 aliases, 30 addresses, 12 Social Security cards. She has been collecting veterans' benefits for 4 deceased husbands. In all, collected over $150,000 of public assistance. That story had a face, a villain, an outrage. It boiled down complex policy into cartoon-level sin. Linda Taylor, the real woman behind it, was eventually convicted for approximately $8,000 in welfare fraud, using just 2 aliases, and her case was far from typical. But Reagan's version spread like wildfire, fueled racial paranoia into policy shifts. That one story became the face of an entire system, and it worked. Public support for welfare plummeted. Even people who benefited from social programs started believing they were the problem. That kind of narrative shift doesn't show up in spreadsheets, but it changes the country.
Let me make one thing plain. I respect the right of workers in the private sector to strike. Indeed, as president of my own union, I led the first strike ever called by that union. I guess I'm maybe the first one to ever hold this office who is a lifetime member of an AFL-CIO union. But we cannot compare labor-management relations in the private sector with government. Government cannot close down the assembly line. It has to provide without interruption the protective services which are government's reason for being. It was in recognition of this that the Congress passed a law forbidding strikes by government employees against the public safety. Let me read the solemn oath taken by each of these employees, the sworn affidavit when they accepted their jobs. I am not participating in any strike against the government of the United States or any agency thereof, and I will not so participate while an employee of the government of the United States or any agency thereof. It is for this reason that I must tell those who fail to report for duty this morning, they are in violation of the law, and if they do not report for work within 48 hours, they have forfeited their jobs and will be terminated. End of statement.
In August 1981, Ronald Reagan stepped to the podium and made it plain. Federal workers are not allowed to strike. The law says so. 12,000 air traffic controllers walked off the job anyway. He gave them 48 hours to come back. About 1,300 did. The rest stayed out. On August 5th, Reagan fired 11,345 people in a single stroke and banned them from federal service for life. On the face of it, he wasn't wrong. These were federal employees. They knew the rule. They broke it. He enforced it. In his own words, he wasn't just protecting the government, he was protecting the flying public. That argument is hard to counter. The skies can't be held hostage. But there was another side to it. These controllers weren't asking for yachts and bonuses. They wanted shorter hours, real rest between shifts, updated equipment, and pay that matched the stress of guiding planes through an overloaded system. Their jobs were breaking them. Many believed Reagan would back them. He'd written a campaign letter promising exactly that. Modern systems, more staff, better conditions. That promise vanished the second he took office. The firings broke more than a union. PATCO was decertified, erased. For months, the system limped along on supervisors, military personnel, and retirees. Flight schedules were cut in half. full recovery took nearly a decade. 11,000 families were left with nothing, and every union in America got the message, don't test the line. If the President of the United States is willing to wipe out an entire union overnight, what chance does a factory walkout or a dock strike have? Employers were watching. Over the next decade, private companies borrowed the same playbook. Permanent replacements, decertifications, firings. Strikes dried up. Union membership dropped from 1 in 5 workers in 1980 to barely 1 in 10 today. Wages flatlined while profits climbed. Worker leverage disappeared. Reagan wasn't bluffing. By the law, he was right, but the human cost was staggering. That moment reshaped labor in America, not just for air traffic controllers, but for everyone who works for a living. One decision, one strike, one speech, and the balance of power between labor and management shifted for a generation. Then came deregulation. Reagan believed the private sector could police itself better than any federal agency. So one by one, industries were cut loose. Banking, telecommunications, airlines, energy. One of the most overlooked deregulations came in the media. In 1987, Reagan's FCC repealed the Fairness Doctrine, a rule that had required broadcasters to present opposing viewpoints on controversial issues. That repeal didn't make headlines, but it made history. It cleared the way for partisan talk radio, 24-hour opinion-based news, and the echo chambers we now call political media. In Reagan's America, information itself was deregulated. The rules that had been put in place after the Great Depression, rules meant to prevent monopoly, exploitation, price gouging, were rolled back or removed entirely. At first, it seemed like a boom. Fares dropped, services expanded, competition grew. But as companies merged, as giants absorbed smaller players, as loopholes widened and oversight shrunk, the long-term costs began to show. Take airlines, for example. Deregulation initially brought cheaper tickets, but it also led to wage cuts, job instability, and reduced service in smaller cities. The same story unfolded in media. Without the Fairness Doctrine, broadcasters no longer needed to balance perspective, they just needed ratings. Rush Limbaugh exploded onto the national scene. News became entertainment, opinion became branding, and truth? Truth became optional. Reagan didn't invent fake news, but he opened the door to a world where facts were negotiable and narrative was king. In banking, the seeds of the 2008 financial crisis were quietly planted during the Reagan years. The savings and loan crisis, a major banking scandal that cost taxpayers billions, started during his second term. But the philosophy didn't change. Deregulation remained the rule, not the exception. The idea was simple. The less government in the way, the better the market would behave. But markets don't have ethics. They have incentives. And Reagan's policies rewarded consolidation, not accountability. Throughout all of this, Reagan remained incredibly popular, even as deficits ballooned, even as inequality grew, even as families struggled to make ends meet. Because to many Americans, he still represented hope. Not necessarily results, but hope. He made people feel like things were getting better, even when they weren't. And for a lot of voters, that was enough. But if you pull the thread, you see the shift. Before Reagan, America had problems, but there was a belief that government could fix them. After Reagan, the idea of government as a solution was treated like a joke. Helping the poor was seen as encouraging weakness. Supporting unions was framed as outdated. Regulations were treated like handcuffs instead of guardrails. That wasn't just a policy shift, that was a cultural shift, and we've never gone back. This is the part that gets missed. People talk about Reaganomics like it was just a tax plan. It wasn't. It was a full-scale reshaping of how America sees success. It said if you're struggling, it's your fault. If you're poor, you're lazy. If you're rich, you're smart. It said that government is the problem and business is the solution. Even if business cuts corners, dodges taxes, outsources jobs, and breaks laws. It said that freedom means fending for yourself and anything else is socialism. And once that idea took root, it became bipartisan. Democrats started trimming programs too. Clinton passed welfare reform. Obama talked about belt tightening. Everyone started playing by the same rule book, even if they didn't believe in it, because Reagan didn't just change the numbers, he changed the narrative. While Reagan was reshaping the economy through tax cuts and deregulation, the social systems around that economy, the ones people actually lived inside, were shifting just as hard. Education, public health, housing, mental health services, and federal civil rights enforcement were all being redefined under the same philosophy. The less the government does, the better. It wasn't a soft rollback. It was a hard cut. And it didn't just change what the government spent. It changed what the country expected from the government altogether. Start with mental health. When Reagan became governor of California in the late 1960s, he'd already shown his hand. He slashed state funding for mental institutions and pushed for the deinstitutionalization of patients. That same approach went national when he became president. In 1981, Congress passed the Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act, a massive spending bill that consolidated federal mental health programs into block grants and handed them to the states. On paper, this gave states flexibility. In practice, it stripped away oversight, accountability, and long-term care funding. Facilities closed, programs dried up, patients were dumped into underfunded community clinics or left to fend for themselves. You want to understand the rise of mass homelessness in the 1980s? Start there. Mental health cuts, affordable housing cuts, job training cuts, all happening while cities faced shrinking budgets and rising poverty. It didn't happen in a vacuum. It was the direct result of policy, and the administration's response wasn't to reinvest, it was to redefine the problem. Homelessness became a personal failure, not a structural one. The country got used to seeing people sleeping on sidewalks. It became background noise. That shift in visibility, what people were willing to walk past without flinching, was cultural, but the spark was policy. Education didn't fare much better. Reagan pushed to abolish the Department of Education outright. He didn't succeed, but funding was slashed dramatically. Between 1980 and 1983, federal education spending dropped by over 20%. Programs for low-income students, bilingual education, and arts instruction were hit hardest. Student loan programs were trimmed down, making college less accessible for working-class families. The message was consistent across the board. The federal government shouldn't be responsible for what happens in classrooms. Let the states figure it out. The long-term effect was a widening gap between rich and poor districts. Wealthier communities with stronger tax bases could support their schools. Poorer communities couldn't. Federal equity efforts stalled. Civil rights enforcement around desegregation and equal opportunity slowed down. And though Reagan didn't openly dismantle integration efforts, his Justice Department backed away from court-mandated busing and affirmative action enforcement. It was a quieter form of rollback, done not through headline policy, but through inaction, delay, and refusal to pursue lawsuits. And then there was AIDS. In June 1981, the CDC published its first official report of what would later be known as HIV/AIDS. By the end of Reagan's first year in office, dozens of cases had been identified, mostly among gay men in major cities. By the end of 1982, there were hundreds, then thousands. It took Reagan over 4 years, till 1985, to publicly say the word AIDS. Not because he didn't know about it. His own Surgeon General, Dr. C. Everett Koop, urged for federal action. Reagan's advisors, many of whom viewed the disease as a gay issue, downplayed the urgency. Some even laughed about it during press briefings. By the time Reagan addressed AIDS in a public speech, more than 12,000 Americans had already died. Funding lagged behind, public education campaigns were delayed, gay communities, left to fend for themselves, created their own health networks, advocacy coalitions, and emergency support systems. The Reagan administration didn't just miss the early window, it actively avoided it. And that silence shaped the country's moral posture toward the crisis. It made it okay to look away. Meanwhile, Reagan was ramping up another crisis, the war on drugs. It didn't start with him. Nixon had already coined the phrase, but Reagan gave it teeth. In 1982, he launched a full-scale federal crackdown, expanding law enforcement budgets, creating new drug task forces, and pushing mandatory minimum sentencing laws. The media was flooded with stories of crack cocaine. Politicians stoked fear of violent drug users, and communities of color, especially black neighborhoods, became ground zero for over-policing. The numbers tell the story. In 1980, there were about 50,000 people in U.S. prisons for drug offenses. By 1989, that number had jumped to over 400,000. Crack and powder cocaine were treated differently in court. 5 grams of crack carried the same sentence as 500 grams of powder, despite being pharmacologically identical. And who used what was no secret? Crack was associated with black communities, powder with white and affluent users. One group got treatment, the other got prison time. Reagan didn't create racial disparity in sentencing, but he locked it into policy. And once it was locked, it never fully got undone. The 1994 crime bill under Clinton expanded on it. States followed the federal lead. Police budgets exploded. Prison construction became a boom industry. And the idea that tough on crime meant long sentences, low tolerance, and zero rehabilitation became a bipartisan standard. And yet, through all of this, Reagan remained a symbol of optimism. His approval ratings stayed high. His speeches were filled with phrases like "morning in America" and "renewed spirit." He projected strength, stability, tradition, and people bought it because many of these social consequences weren't visible to the average voter, or they were easy to rationalize. It's hard to be outraged by cuts to public housing if you've never needed it. It's easy to support drug crackdowns if you've never had a family member get caught in the system. This is the story Reagan rarely gets asked to answer for. Not because it wasn't public, but because the myth of his success has always been louder than the facts of his impact. He made people feel good about the country again. But feeling good doesn't always mean doing good. And when you peel back the policies, when you actually follow what got signed, what got vetoed, what got ignored, you see a clear pattern. Support was cut from the most vulnerable. Accountability was removed from the most powerful. And the price wasn't paid in dollars. It was paid in lives, in years lost, in systems that still haven't recovered. This isn't about demonizing Reagan. It's about facing the record. And the record shows that the same presidency that re-energized a nation also institutionalized indifference. Whether that was the goal or the side effect is up to interpretation. But the effects were real, and they didn't stop when he left office. Ronald Reagan didn't invent American power, but he absolutely redefined how it could be used and where. The presidency had always been able to move troops, sign treaties, and shape diplomacy. But Reagan brought something new to the table, performance as posture. Foreign policy wasn't just strategy anymore, it was theater. He understood the camera angles, the language of confrontation, the staging of conflict. He knew how to make America look strong, even if the details underneath were messy. And that shift from substance to spectacle reshaped how every president after him would conduct war, peace, and everything in between. Start with the Cold War. By 1981, the Soviet Union was already stretched thin. Internally, it was facing economic decay, political stagnation, and unrest in its satellite states. But Reagan didn't soften. He went full tilt. He called the USSR an evil empire. He ramped up defense spending to levels unseen since World War II. He pushed Congress to approve the Strategic Defense Initiative, nicknamed Star Wars, a space-based missile defense system that most scientists admitted wouldn't actually work, but it didn't need to work. It just needed to look like it could. And that was the point. Reagan's goal wasn't just deterrence, it was dominance. Psychological warfare on a global scale. The military budget exploded. From 1981 to 1985, defense spending increased by over 40%. new weapon systems, aircraft carriers, nuclear submarines, all justified by the looming threat of communism. And Reagan believed it. He wasn't pretending. He saw the Cold War as moral combat, not just capitalism versus communism, but good versus evil. That kind of framing made compromise feel like betrayal, which is why, for most of his first term, diplomacy took a backseat to posturing. But eventually, behind closed doors, Reagan shifted. By his second term, he was meeting with Mikhail Gorbachev. He signed the INF Treaty in 1987, eliminating an entire class of nuclear weapons. He backed off the rhetoric, softened the posture, and moved toward negotiation. It worked. The Berlin Wall didn't fall during his presidency, but his fingerprints were on it. That part of his legacy is real. It's not myth. The Cold War didn't end because of Reagan alone, but his shift from escalation to diplomacy helped open the door. Still, while the cameras focused on Europe, his administration was busy working in the shadows elsewhere. Covert operations, proxy wars, regime destabilizations. It wasn't just about the USSR, it was about influence. And Reagan's team was willing to bend or break international norms to secure it. Take Central America. In Nicaragua, the leftist Sandinista government had taken power. Reagan saw them as Marxist puppets for Moscow. So the US backed the Contras, a rebel group made up of former regime loyalists, paramilitary fighters, and, by multiple reports, known human rights abusers. The US sent them money, weapons, training. Congress found out and passed the Boland Amendment, making it illegal for the government to continue supporting the Contras. Reagan's team did it anyway. This is where the Iran-Contra affair begins, arguably the most infamous scandal of his presidency. In short, the administration secretly sold arms to Iran, a country they had labeled a state sponsor of terrorism, in exchange for hostages. They took the money from those arms sales and funneled it to the Contras. Multiple layers of illegal activity. Lied to Congress, lied to the public. When it broke, Reagan claimed he had no knowledge of the details, and maybe he didn't, but the people under him did. National Security Advisor John Poindexter and Colonel Oliver North became the faces of the operation. Documents were shredded, testimonies conflicted, accountability blurred, poll numbers dropped, but not enough to define his presidency. That's what's so striking. Iran-Contra didn't tank Reagan the way Watergate tanked Nixon. His personal likability shielded him. People didn't want to believe the man who won 49 states could lie. So they moved on. Congress held hearings. Some convictions happened. Most were later overturned or pardoned. The scandal faded, but the precedent stuck. Then there was El Salvador, where the U.S. funded a right-wing military fighting a leftist insurgency. Tens of thousands of civilians were killed during the Civil War. Death squads, many trained with American dollars, left a brutal legacy. Reagan stood by the Salvadoran government, calling them a bulwark against communism. He did the same in Guatemala, supporting regimes with long records of repression, torture, and civilian massacres. The pattern was clear. If a government was anti-communist, they got support. Full stop. Human rights records were secondary. In Afghanistan, the U.S. funneled billions to the Mujahideen, fighting the Soviet occupation. Reagan called them freedom fighters. Later, some of those fighters would evolve into factions we now associate with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. At the time, it didn't matter. The priority was bleeding Moscow. All of this was framed as containment, but it wasn't just containment, it was projection. Reagan projected American power into every corner of the globe. Not always through direct war, but through influence, arms, and allies. The line between defense and offense became murky. And this is where the conversation about executive power starts to shift. Reagan didn't just act boldly, he acted quietly. During Reagan's two terms, the CIA's covert operations budget and authority expanded sharply, with more non-public actions authorized than under any previous presidency. In the early 1980s, internal planning documents from the CIA show that long-range strategy under Reagan focused on significantly scaling up covert programs and intelligence technical collection. A leaked CIA long-term plan from 1980 recommended ramping up technical assets and expanding clandestine activity, even as the agency admitted it didn't fully understand what should remain classified. These plans formed the basis of Reagan-era expansion. Additionally, the Reagan administration centralized control of intelligence budgeting through reforms like consolidating the National Foreign Intelligence Program, NFIP, under stronger executive oversight, reducing congressional visibility into covert spending. While Congress formally set the budget, much of the Elvis Black budget flow was managed from the White House and the National Security Council, minimizing external scrutiny. The CIA's global covert footprint rose dramatically under what became known as the Reagan Doctrine, which openly endorsed and secretly funded anti-communist resistance movements in countries like Afghanistan, Nicaragua, Angola, Cambodia, and Guatemala. By 1987, the U.S. was funneling over $600 million per year into the Afghan Mujahideen through CIA channels. The agency's Special Activities Division played a central role, deploying paramilitary officers directly on the battlefield. Working quietly with NSC staffers, some operating outside formal CIA control, the administration authorized actions that Congress had specifically barred, including covert contrafunding after the Boland Amendment. These layers of secrecy, classified budgets, signing statements, and executive directives started to reshape executive power, not through open legislation, but through concealed flows of money and authority. In short, Reagan didn't just act, he shifted the stage. Intelligence and covert operations became tools of the presidency, not just the agencies. And future administrations would inherit not just the machinery, but the playbook. This wasn't just a Reagan thing, but it accelerated under him. The use of signing statements, secret directives, unilateral military action, these tools became normalized, and future presidents would use them, expand them, rely on them. The imperial presidency didn't start in the 1980s, but it got a major upgrade during Reagan's terms. And through it all, Reagan's image stayed largely intact, because he was careful. The heavy lifting happened behind the scenes. What the public saw were speeches at the Brandenburg Gate, state dinners with allies, naval flyovers, clean shots, easy stories. Most Americans didn't follow what was happening in El Salvador or Angola or Lebanon. They just saw a president who seemed strong, in control, presidential. That's the part that sticks. He didn't just build policy, he built a blueprint for power. He showed that as long as the story looks good, people won't ask too many questions about the footnotes. That doctrine, Project Confidence, Shield the Details, has become the default setting for modern American foreign policy. What Reagan left behind wasn't just a military budget or a list of alliances. He left behind a method, a performance structure, one where presidents could speak like statesmen while acting like CEOs, one where war didn't have to be declared to be waged, one where allies didn't have to be democratic, just useful. And in doing so, he left us with a question that still lingers. Is American strength measured by what we protect or by what we ignore? Because in Reagan's era, we did both, and we're still living in the balance. Reagan left office in 1989, but his policies never really left. They just changed hands, changed names, got rebranded, modernized, and repackaged by the presidents who came after him, Democrats and Republicans alike. His version of leadership didn't disappear. It became the default. And the consequences of that shift are still showing up in today's economy, political structure, and cultural division. Start with taxes. The Economic Recovery Tax Act of 1981, which slashed the top marginal tax rate from 70% to 50%, wasn't a one-time break. It was a philosophical pivot. By the end of Reagan's presidency, the top rate had dropped again, all the way down to 28%. And while later administrations nudged it back up, under George H.W. Bush and Clinton, the overall direction never fully reversed. Tax cuts for high earners became the cornerstone of conservative policy. Reagan proved that cutting taxes, especially for the wealthy, could be sold not as favoritism, but as fuel for growth. the job creator narrative was born. That narrative still shapes today's economic policy, whether it's Bush's 2001 and 2003 tax cuts, Trump's 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, or constant debates about death taxes and capital gains. The Reagan logic that cutting top-end taxes stimulates the economy has held steady, even as data has consistently shown that the benefits tend to concentrate at the top. The branding stuck. Reagan made it politically dangerous to question tax cuts. That fear still drives fiscal policy 40 years later. Then there's deregulation. Reagan rolled back rules on banking, energy, telecommunications, transportation, and more, all under the banner of free enterprise. His administration took a hands-off approach to corporate consolidation and antitrust enforcement. That hands-off stance created the opening for the S&L crisis, a financial disaster in the late 80s and early 90s that cost taxpayers over $120 billion. But the general philosophy, government needs to get out of the way, persisted. It echoed into Clinton's repeal of Glass-Steagall in 1999, which allowed commercial and investment banks to merge and helped set the stage for the 2008 housing crash. The pattern is consistent. Reagan didn't just pass policies. He made certain moves politically untouchable. Deregulation became a default, not a debate. Presidents who followed didn't always agree with him, but most chose not to reverse him. On labor, the PACO firings didn't just break a union, they broke momentum. Private sector union membership has fallen every decade since. The share of workers covered by collective bargaining dropped from over 20% in 1980 to under 10% today. Wages, adjusted for inflation, have barely moved for most American workers. Job protections weakened, retirement security eroded, and the public, shaped by decades of messaging that unions were corrupt or lazy, rarely fought back. Reagan made anti-union sentiment sound like common sense, and that narrative got repeated so often it started to feel like truth. In education, the cuts Reagan pushed through sent a signal that public schooling was a state problem, not a national one. Over time, that mindset helped pave the way for school voucher movements, charter school expansions, and the idea that competition, not investment, would fix failing schools. What began as budget cuts morphed into a full redefinition of responsibility. Reagan didn't shut down the Department of Education, but he tried. And that alone was enough to shift the conversation from how do we fix public schools to should public schools even be fixed at all? And then there's welfare. Even today, phrases like welfare queen and entitlement reform show up in speeches and headlines. Reagan didn't invent them, but he gave them oxygen. His stories about fraud and abuse laid the groundwork for 1996's Welfare Reform Act under Clinton, which ended direct cash assistance as an entitlement and added strict work requirements. Today, only a small fraction of families in poverty receive cash benefits at all. Welfare, once seen as a safety net, is now often framed as a last resort for the desperate or a crutch for the undeserving. That framing started in the Reagan years. The criminal justice system followed the same path. Reagan's war on drugs, mandatory minimums, expanded policing, and aggressive federal funding set the tone. But the blueprint didn't stay in Republican hands. Clinton's 1994 crime bill built on it. Obama-era grants continued to support militarized local police forces. Even now, the political cost of being seen as soft on crime remains high. Mass incarceration wasn't just a moment, it became infrastructure. And that infrastructure was laid in the 1980s. Even political rhetoric, the language of campaigns, traces back to Reagan. He taught both parties that people respond more to emotion than to policy, that television matters more than truth, that a confident delivery can erase a complex record. His speeches weren't just persuasive, they were engineered for belief. Government is the problem, a shining city on a hill. Trust, but verify. These weren't just lines, they were hooks. He didn't explain, he declared. And most politicians today, on both sides, still mimic that cadence. Short, confident, moral, simple. You see his fingerprints everywhere. In tax code, in education, in the structure of labor, in how America treats poverty, in how it defines leadership. You don't have to agree with him to admit that he changed the country. The real question is whether we've ever stopped following his lead or if we even know how to. Policy tells you what a president does. Culture tells you what a country believes about it. And Reagan didn't just change what America did, he changed what it wanted to believe about itself. That legacy is harder to measure, but it's deeper than legislation. It's in the language. It's in the symbols. It's in the way people talk about patriotism, crime, religion, freedom, even when they're not quoting him directly. He didn't invent those ideas. He curated them. He organized them into a clear moral hierarchy. And then he wrapped it in a smile and handed it to the public like scripture. Start with race. Reagan was careful. He didn't use slurs. He didn't speak in the openly segregationist language of George Wallace, but he didn't have to. His language was coded, calculated, and just distant enough to feel safe. The idea of the welfare queen wasn't about race on paper, but the image he painted, a woman in Chicago driving a Cadillac, abusing the system under multiple identities, was racially loaded by design. The actual woman he was referencing, Linda Taylor, committed fraud, yes, but the version Reagan told was exaggerated beyond recognition. He turned a single case into a stand-in for an entire system, and the public bought it. Welfare wasn't a poverty issue anymore. It became a black issue. And from that point forward, attacking welfare came with moral permission. He applied the same logic to crime. During his presidency, especially in the lead-up to the war on drugs, Reagan talked often about law and order. He warned of predators, of growing danger in American cities. He increased funding for police departments. He signed legislation that expanded mandatory minimum sentences. But what mattered most wasn't just what the laws said, it was how they were marketed. The crack epidemic was framed as a crisis of violence, not addiction. And the face of that crisis, in the media and in politics, was black. That framing had consequences. Public support for tough-on-crime policies skyrocketed. The prison population exploded, and the communities most affected were pushed further into economic instability, generational trauma, and state surveillance. Reagan didn't use the language of white supremacy, but the structures his administration reinforced operated with its logic. His speeches never blamed Black America directly. They just made it easier for the public to do it without guilt. Then came religion. Reagan forged a bond with the religious right, unlike anything seen before in presidential politics. Groups like the Moral Majority and Focus on the Family found in him a champion who wasn't just friendly to their values, he embodied them. He spoke about God openly. He invoked scripture at campaign rallies. He tied faith to patriotism and morality to party lines. It didn't matter that Reagan didn't attend church regularly. What mattered was that he gave religious conservatives the respect and visibility they'd been demanding. And he gave them access. Under Reagan, the Christian right moved from the sidelines to the strategy table. Issues like school prayer, abortion, family values, and textbook content weren't just cultural debates, they became political leverage. And once that bridge was built, it never came down. Today's battles over LGBTQ+ rights, sex education, and religious freedom laws all trace back to the Reagan years, when belief became legislation and the church became a voting bloc. Then there's the idea of America itself. Reagan told a very specific version of the American story, a nostalgic one. Shining city on a hill, morning in America. These weren't just campaign slogans, they were myth-making tools. He framed the 1950s as the moral high point of American culture, before civil unrest, before counterculture, before government grew too big. He told people that greatness was behind them and that his presidency could bring it back. That kind of storytelling is powerful. It makes change feel like loss. It turns progress into erosion, and it makes restoration sound like redemption. Reagan's America wasn't about confronting hard truths. It was about escaping them. It didn't matter that the 1950s were also marked by segregation, gender inequality, and suppressed dissent. What mattered was that the image felt clean. That image still shapes how people vote today. Look at any campaign that promises to take the country back or return to traditional values. They're not just echoing Reagan's tone, they're using his template. And that template is durable because it doesn't rely on facts, it relies on feelings. That's the heart of Reagan's cultural legacy. He trained American politics to prioritize narrative over nuance. He didn't lie openly, but he told incomplete truths with confidence. And that method, story first, policy second, is now the dominant mode of political communication. It's why social media rewards outrage. It's why politicians repeat slogans that don't survive scrutiny. It's why simple answers keep winning in a complicated world. And this is where it gets complicated, because Reagan wasn't a villain. He wasn't a demagogue. He wasn't hateful, but he was powerful. And power, when exercised without full accountability, leaves marks. Some people credit him with restoring national pride. Others say he set fire to the social contract. Both can be true. That's the hard part of legacy. It doesn't require one answer. The point isn't to rewrite Reagan's history, it's to finish it, to tell the parts that weren't in the commercials, to look past the smile and into the systems he built. Because whether you admire him or not, Ronald Reagan's influence is still shaping the debates we're having today on race, on class, on faith, on truth itself. And until we name that influence, we're not actually arguing about policy. We're just living inside his story without knowing who wrote it.